Hello and welcome to Dark Chats About Space. It's a podcast all about space. Now this is episode 6 and it's all about space junk. Space junk are the bits of satellite and rocket that are no longer in use that orbit planet Earth and are increasingly posing danger to not only live operational satellites and spacecraft and astronauts, but also pose some very serious problems here on Earth. I chatted to Richard Duke from the Surrey Space Centre, who is part of the Remove Debris programme that has a solution for dealing with this junk. And they hit the international headlines earlier this year, about a month ago, following the live tests of their Space Harpoon and Space Net. Not only is it fascinating to hear about the Harpoon and Net specifically, but also to hear the journey of getting the Remove Debris satellite into space in the first place, involving Airbus and Elon Musk and the International Space Station and the astronauts on the station itself. So I hope you're going to enjoy this conversation. Before we get on with it, this podcast is brought to you by my book, Dark, the A to Z of Astronomy and the Cosmos. If you like space, which I'm assuming you do from listening to this podcast in the first place, then I think you might like my book. So every chapter in my book deals with a different space-related subject as an A to Z, and the whole book is beautifully designed and illustrated, so it's part universe explainer and part aesthetically beautiful coffee table fodder. It's with crowdfunding publisher Unbound, and being a rather niche genre fusing graphic design and space, the only way I'm going to get it made is if I get it in front of space-loving people like yourselves. So if it sounds up your street, then please go and have a look at unbound.com/books/dark. I'm currently on 48% funding, so any extra pledges towards the book, I would be eternally grateful to you. And everybody who does pledge for the book in its first run gets their name in the back, but there's also lots of different pledge levels, so you can get limited edition prints of the artwork and so on and so forth. So please go and have a look. Anyway, enough waffle about my book. Let's get on with my chat with Richard Duke. Are you ready? Let's go. Okay, thank you so much, Richard Duke, for joining me today to talk about the Remove Debris program. We're actually sitting here right now in the mission control room for the Surrey Space Centre. It's a really fascinating place, and I've just seen an amazing piece of footage that actually was taken on the edge of the International Space Station of the Remove Debris satellite just over the south coast of England, which is just the most beautiful imagery. But we're going to come on a little bit later on to talk about the Remove Debris program in more detail, but I wanted to start off with your background. You studied here at Surrey University doing space technology and planetary exploration. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So the degree at the university here was actually really good, because when you work in space, it's very multidisciplinary. Mm. So you're not just, it's not just a computer program or just hardware or electronics. It's basically everything. So the master's degree here that I did was very good in that you learnt about some mechanical stuff, you learnt about mission planning, you learnt a bit with software and algorithms, and you learnt a lot about the electronics as well. So it was a degree really focused on some of all the different bits of space that you need to then build your spacecraft.
So was your interest in this field, was it born of a love of space, or as a love of engineering, or a love of physics, or a hybrid of all three?
It was actually quite a bit of a hybrid, because when I was really young, I got very inspired by the Mars Pathfinder mission. Mm. So it was always very space, very planetary science, and very physics-based. As I grew up, I actually started to work for an engineering company, and I also became really interested in the space shuttle and the International Space Station, because I could see it, being built and everything like that. And I sort of realised I was probably better at the engineering side of things than the physics side. Mm. So what I decided to do is actually work in engineering, but, in a job like this, we're using physics all the time to make things happen.
So what's the main projects that take place at the Surrey Space Centre? What's the main purpose of the Space Centre?
So the Surrey Space Centre is actually quite wide in terms of its reach. So in terms of the academic side, we have I think something like 80 researchers, and a lot of that is doing real new in-depth novel research. We have astrophysics, we have remote sensing. We have computer science and avionics for spacecraft. We have all the different elements you need to build space missions. But what we also do here, which is quite unique for the UK, is we actually build spacecraft ourselves. So at the moment, the focus is on CubeSats. So as we try to miniaturize the satellites as much as possible, because when it's smaller, the cheaper to launch. So we work a lot with this miniaturization of satellites. And this is what the Space Center has been well known for the last 30 years as well. It's constantly trying to push the boundaries and using newer technology and smaller spacecraft to do the same job as bigger spacecraft.
Because I'm guessing for everything that is launched, you know, away from planet Earth into space, just costs an inordinate amount of money. So the smaller it can get, the more feasible it is in the future.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that we've done really well here, and we tested out quite successfully about a year and a half ago now, was a mission called Inflate Sail. So this was actually testing how you can get a big sail in space. And you can use sails for then deorbiting spacecraft, and you can actually use them for solar sailing as well. So you can actually push your spacecraft using effectively the rays from the sun. But these sails, even for a small spacecraft, have to be like 16 square meters. So of course, how do you pack a 16 square meter sail and pack it into something that's about 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters wide? So that's a lot of the work we do here, is how can you really package things up small, so then you've got big structures in space when you get up there.
And you've been working here for a number of years now. So what's your role here?
So I've actually had several different roles here. So initially I started off with the software engineering. So I started work on the avionics software and also the ground station software as well, because we obviously have both the space and the ground side, and they both need to talk to each other and work together. So I started off with the software, and we started building the operating systems that all the satellites that we use. And then moved on to there, mainly to the operations and ground station side, or mission control side, as everybody will know it. So this is where we basically spend more time, you know, actually working with the satellites to make sure that once we've built them, we actually get the full use out of them.
So let's come on to the topic, you know, that I'm here to sort of address, which is space junk.
Yeah.
For want of a better term, is there an official term that's less sort of media focused, or is space junk the widely accepted scientific term?
It's fairly widely accepted. The other term is space debris, actually. So we often say space debris instead of space junk in day-to-day lives, but it means the same thing.
And so just give me a sort of a top line sort of idea. What is space junk?
So basically, space junk is anything in space that we're not using, that's not actively useful. So the majority of this is basically bits of old satellite. So we put a satellite up there, we get a lot of use out of it for a few years, and then eventually it will cease to operate and it becomes unuseful. But then after that, it's basically just debris. It's just a bit of junk up in space. So in the same way as you have junk in the oceans and all this plastic and that, we're also leaving stuff in space. Now the problem is, you know, with the oceans, of course, it's a major hazard to wildlife. In space, although there's not a lot of junk up there, it's actually really, really dangerous to anything else, including astronauts and other spacecraft. And that's because everything that's in orbit in space is travelling about 17,000 miles an hour. So even if a tiny fleck of paint or a tiny bit of circuit board were to hit another operational spacecraft, it's just catastrophic.
So what is the magnitude of the problem? How much space junk is up there?
So at the moment, there's about 8,000 tonnes. And some of that is very large objects, so you know, really big spacecraft, and they're relatively easy to track. But there's also a lot of really small objects, and this is a bigger problem when another bit of space junk hits another bit of space junk, because then it just creates even more smaller objects. And some of these objects we can track, but some of them we're completely blind to.
So if there's 8,000 tons up there, how many individual pieces are we looking at?
I don't think anybody knows for sure. I know that there's sort of hundreds of thousands of bits. Again, it all depends on what size you're looking at, because the big pieces you can track easily, but they're going to cause a lot of damage when they hit. The really small pieces might cause a bit least damage, but actually a lot of them we can't track. So it's actually the danger that we try to quantify, not necessarily just the number of bits. And where this becomes really important is how we try to deal with space junk, because a lot of people would say, well, how are you going to collect all the small bits? But actually we're concerned about the large bits, because if you take it's actually taking the amount of mass out that we need to do, because we're not concerned that the large bit will hit something, because we know where it is, But we're concerned about maybe a small bit hits a large bit, and instead of one bit of space debris, you then have 20,000 bits of space debris, or even more. So we're actually more concerned with trying to take the amount of mass out, because it's the potential of what that becomes.
And have there been many collisions already?
Yeah, I mean, we often get quite a lot of small collisions on, especially when you look at things like the International Space Station. They're getting what we call micrometeorite collisions all the time, and these are very, very small things, but still enough to put holes in radiators, and you know, hopefully not the side of an actual module that an astronaut uses. And so the space station is getting hit all the time by this stuff. We've had a very big incident with one of the Iridian spacecraft, and basically that was two old spacecraft that hit each other, and that created an enormous amount of debris after that. And even one of our own spacecraft from several years ago was actually hit by a bit of space debris as well, which, lucky for us, just hit the antenna. So we had difficulty communicating with it, but it didn't, fortunately for us, actually damage the spacecraft, so it was unusable.
Good grief, and extraordinarily expensive as well.
Yes.
So there's obviously a lot of problems that can be faced in terms of collisions in orbit, but are there any problems that face people actually on planet Earth? How do people on Earth suffer the consequences of space debris?
Yeah, so this is actually a really important question, because space debris actually affects us on Earth, not because we're actually going to get hit by a bit of space debris, because it's quite unlikely that anything will come down and hit anybody, but it's because of the applications that we use on Earth that we need satellites for. So, you know, I mean, the obvious one that everybody talks about is GPS navigation or weather satellites. So, you know, how we know the weather, how we can navigate is all down to that. But there's also an awful lot that people don't realise that we use satellites for. The biggest example I can say is stuff like crop management. So what's starting to happen a lot now is actually farmers will get information from satellites to how their crop is doing. So instead of having to spray, say, pesticide over the entire crop, they can just say, actually, we need pesticide at this bit of the area and this bit. And so that saves them a lot of money and also helps the environment as well. Problem is, if you're to do this from a plane, it would take so much effort to like effectively photograph the entire planet. But a satellite can do this in one day. So often we use satellites not because we can only do it from space, but because it's far cheaper and far more environmentally friendly to put something in orbit and have it do the entire planet in one go, rather than try to get the information from every bit of the planet.
Mm.
Perfect example is plastics in the oceans, because at the moment we actually don't have a good idea on exactly where all the plastic is in the oceans, but there's new missions going up now which would basically be able to just spot this from orbit. So we'll know exactly where it is and exactly where the problem is.
And am I right in thinking that there is no regulatory body when it comes to space junk? There's nobody who has an overarching authority?
There is international government conventions, and basically different countries are responsible for the different satellites that they put up. So in theory, they're responsible for than when they become space junk, but there's no convention to actually say how you should clear up space junk. So you're still allowed to take it up there and then leave it there, and yes, you're responsible if it hits anything, but it's all done via intergovernmental coordination.
So probably the most, you know, one of the most prolific kind of orbital bodies at the moment, you know, the International Space Station, especially because it's obviously manned by human beings. What precautions did the ISS take to avoid large, potentially catastrophic collisions with space debris?
Yeah, so the nice thing is that for large objects, we can track them on the ground. So JSPOC in America, which sort of people know it as NORAD up to a point, but they basically track all the objects in space. So especially for the big objects, we know where they are. So what they have to do quite regularly on the space station, and what most spacecraft operators have to do who can do it, they actually have to move their space station out the way of the space junk. But you also get some issues that they've had, especially on the space station, where we actually don't know until the last minute that, you know, there's a potential that space junk could hit the space station. And there's been a few instances where they've not been able to move out of the way in time. So basically, they've just had to cross the fingers and hope they don't get hit. And in those cases, what happens is they actually start to go to their Soyuz capsules, so basically the ships that the spaceships that they launch with, and they basically get in there and close the hatches so that if the space station gets hit, they're already in effectively a lifeboat.
Good grief. So there's actually very, very serious safety protocols in place to quantify this. I suppose that leads us on to the remove debris program here at the Space Centre. So just talk through where we, you know, sort of how the remove debris program came about. Was it just purely born out of a knowledge that something needs to be done about this and the Space Centre were the right people to do it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as a university, what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop the technologies that people will need to actually combat the problem. So before you actually go and fix a problem, you need to develop the technology to help you do that. So we've started to develop a range of technologies at the Space Centre. A lot of these are preventative technologies, so we do a lot of work with space sails and other ways to actually deorbit spacecraft, because that's the easiest way to sort the problem, is if you can send a spacecraft up there and then bring it back by itself at the end of the day, that's ideal. But the problem is, there's a lot of spacecraft that go up there and then there's a problem, so they can't then bring themselves back. And also, for the past 40 years, we've not been doing that, so everything we've been sending up has not come back out of its own accord. So this is why we've started to look at ways we can actually go and clean stuff up, even if, you know, from history, we've been putting it up there and not doing it correct in the past.
Does a programme like Remove Debris begin in a very brainstorm-style fashion? Like, what are all the wild and wonderful and weird possibilities and ways to bring that? Did you begin in the realms of kind of outlandish thinking and then bring it round to the science? Or is it the other way around? Do you begin with the constraints, first of all?
It's quite interesting how programs like this evolve, because obviously there'll probably be a lot of theoretical work that'll be done years before a program like this starts. So somebody will come up with a concept of a harpoon or a net and actually go, well, physically, how could this work? Will it work in space? And so you tend to have a lot of theoretical work that's done quite in advance of projects like this. But then what happens is, of course, when you start to get big issues with space junk, you start to have government agencies and other funding bodies that will start to be able to fund this sort of thing. And then, of course, we get together with our partners, and the ideal is as many partners as possible who can bring technology to the table. So we've removed debris. It's people like Airbus, several different centres of Airbus in France, Germany and the UK, and also SSTL, our commercial partners as well, over on the research park. And we try to bring all these people together to then bid for funding from the, in this case, the European Union, and to actually, you know, try and do a demonstration of the technology. So we've got all the theoretical stuff out of the way, but now we need to demonstrate it before then people will pay to use it.
So what does a partner like Airbus sort of bring to the equation?
Yeah, so in this case, Airbus actually bring two really key technologies. The first one is the Harpoon. But also the other one is the net system. So the net comes from Airbus in Germany, and the Harpoon comes from Airbus in the UK, just in Stevenage.
So let's talk first of all about the Harpoon, which, you know, does sound slightly pirate-like, which does effectively make the Space Centre facilitators of space pirate behaviour. what does just talk me through how the Harpoon works, what it does. I mean, of course, it's to collect this debris, but just talk me through the process.
You know, it's quite interesting, because often we go back to tried and tested methods that they used, you know, thousands of years ago with harpoons and nets. And fundamentally, the harpoon is like any harpoon, you know, it's basically a pointy stick. But we face a lot more different challenges up in space. So the first challenge we face is actually to do with how the harpoon travels, because on the ground, it's all we've got aerodynamics, we've got air. So actually the way everything works is all shaped to move through air. But when we're in space, that's very different, because we've got no air. But so the actual tether that we carry behind it has a lot more say in how the harpoon moves. So that's the first thing that we've got to look at. The second thing that we have to look at is, in space, if we just hit an object, the object will just move away from us, because, you know, there's nothing stopping it. So we have to fire with a velocity that will make sure the harpoon goes straight through the target before it starts to move. But then we actually have to make sure that we basically grab the target and we don't let it go. So we actually have these barbs that actually come out once it's gone through the panel or whatever we're trying to grab, and basically just fan out and then grab the space debris. So then we hold it nice and securely so it doesn't float away.
So when was the first in-orbit testing of this space harpoon?
So the first in-orbit testing of the space harpoon was not that long ago. It was probably about a month and a half, 2 months ago now.
Which sort of gathered global news coverage.
Yes,
which was the first time I'd heard about it as well.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, which was fantastic. So if anything, before, let's sort of backtrack a moment. So Remove Debris is the name itself for the cubic satellite.
Yes.
That is experimenting with removing debris from space.
Yes.
And just for the benefit of the listeners, Richard took me for a quick tour of the Space Center before we began this conversation, and seeing images of Remove Debris itself, it's kind of the size of a large tumble dryer, you will, albeit a little bit more kind of complicated.
It looks like one as well.
It looks a bit like a tumble dryer as well. So, let's talk through how did that sort of get to space? You know, what was the process in getting that into orbit in the first place?
Yeah, so actually, we had a lot of fun with just getting the spacecraft to space for this one. Because of the way we launched it was actually quite experimental, just in the launch itself. Normally, we would just go through an India, often a rocket from India, and we would just basically you get attached to it, and then you just pop off when you get into space. It's nice and simple. But this one was slightly different in that we actually use the International Space Station as a launch platform. So the first thing we did was we had to speak to NanoRacks in the US, who actually coordinate this stuff. And what we did is we used Elon Musk from SpaceX, very much as a DHL delivery driver or a Royal Mail delivery. And what they did is they popped us in a bag, basically, took us up to the space station and handed us to the astronauts.
So you deliver Remove Debris satellite in packaging to SpaceX.
Yes.
SpaceX load it onto one of their sort of rockets.
Yeah.
And then SpaceX deliver that rocket into the International Space Station.
Yeah, exactly. So SpaceX have a lot of the Dragon capsules, as they're called, going up to the space station for normal deliveries, for just, you know, to support the astronauts. And what we were able to do is we were able to get a bit of that space in the SpaceX capsule just dedicated to us, so we could they could just deliver us just like a normal package.
And another short video clip that you showed me showed some of the most wonderful minds on our planet, the astronauts of the ISS, essentially unpacking Remove Debris from what looks like kind of polystyrene IKEA style packaging, and then sort of doing the assembly job for you guys. So that was wonderful to see.
Yeah, exactly. And this was actually quite interesting for us as well. So normally we would be very careful in how we build satellites, and the last person to touch the satellite would be ourselves, because we would attach it to the rocket and we attach it all in a way so we're the last person to touch it. Of course, this time we weren't actually doing the final final assembly and the final preparation for it, so we had to work with the astronauts, NASA and NanoRacks, to actually work out all the procedures that the astronauts would need to actually make sure that they could do the final preparation.
Well, you would hope that astronauts, if anyone on the planet, anyone off the planet is capable of attention to detail and following
exactly,
the minutiae instructions, you'd hope that astronauts would do it.
Yeah.
So Remove Debris arrives on the International Space Station, the astronauts unpack it, and then they have to facilitate the launch of that module.
Yeah.
Where does it go within the space station, and how is it administered, and then how does it exit the ISS?
Yeah, so getting it in there is quite easy, because of course they're delivering all the cargo with the SpaceX capsules, so they can just bring Remove Debris basically through the hatch. We then went into the Japanese laboratory to actually do the final assembly. So that's where the astronauts did the assembly there. We're actually on board for about 2 months almost, basically just packaged up before they had time to work and get us out there. And actually that's also one of the other interesting things that we had to consider as well, is because very rarely do you have to human rate a satellite. So actually normally when a satellite's in space, nobody's going to touch it, so it's actually quite safe. But actually when you're on the International Space Station, you've got astronauts up there that could be harmed by it. So even things as simple as like sharp edges and stuff like that, we had to be really careful during the design phase to make sure that we didn't injure any astronauts, because of course if they get a cut up there, it's a bit more serious than potentially than down here. But yeah, so they unpacked us on the in the Japanese laboratory, and they connected to what we call the Kaber interface, and that's an interface in the Japanese airlock. And basically, if they connect us to that, they could then transfer us through the Japanese airlock. And what would normally happen for a lot of satellites is the Japanese robotic arm would come round, grab us out, so we're in space then, and then just drop us off. But for our mission, because this is the biggest spacecraft the space station has ever launched by quite a long way, the Japanese robotic arm couldn't actually do it. So we actually had to get the astronauts to drive the main space station robotic arm, the Canadian one, actually round to us to pick us up, and then they could drop us off from the main space station arm.
So then once removed debris is in orbit, how long did it take from there to do the first successful Harpoon test?
So it actually took several months, because the first thing that we do when we launch a satellite is we actually have to check it all out. So it's not quite as simple as, you know, just getting a new phone from a shop and just switching it on. We actually have to go through really methodically every subsystem, make sure every system is safe and operating normally. We also had to wait for a while, because obviously NASA are quite worried when we have harpoons on board the space station anywhere near it, especially ones that are specifically designed to go through the side of a satellite.
So it really does not want to be accidentally set off.
Yeah, so we had to do a lot of work on the safety of that while we're on there. But actually, we then had to wait for quite a long time to make sure that we were quite a long way from the space station when we started to do these experiments, because we don't want to launch any harpoons off into space and then they'd come back around and hit the space station. So we had to wait for that. We also had to wait quite a long time to get the right lighting conditions as well, because when we do these experiments, the one shot, we've only got one chance of doing all these experiments. We can't just try it again. So we need to make sure that the lighting for the cameras, which fundamentally is what everybody's going to look at to see if it was successful or not, was just right.
And then the first time you did it, this wasn't with a piece of existing space debris, was it? This was something that was a projectile from a removed debris satellite itself.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things, because we're just trying to demonstrate the technologies and we're trying to build our knowledge up, we don't want to do everything at once, because we'll never be able to do that. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to demonstrate these technologies under very controlled circumstances. So instead of going up and getting a bit of space debris that we don't know what it looks like, you know, we only find out when we get there how we're, you know, any problems, we actually take up our own space debris effectively. Now, this space debris is actually quite clever. It's got its own electronics in there. It's effectively its own little satellite. And it's the CubeSats, which we specialise at the university here. So we send these up, and for the net, this was actually had an inflatable structure in it. And the idea was we wanted to practice capturing space debris about a metre across. So we send one of our small CubeSats up, which is only 10 centimetres by 20 centimetres. But then that could have an inflatable, so it could simulate a big piece of space debris.
Gotcha. So that's the other side of removed debris methodology. So you've got the space harpoon, which fires out from removed debris, pierces a hole, and then grabs the debris, and then drags it back down towards orbit. Is that correct? So it can burn up. But then you've got the net, which kind of should encapsulate in some way space debris, and then do the same job of dragging it down.
Yeah, right? No, exactly. And even the net is quite special. So when we fire the net, again, just like the harpoon, that if you just fire a net at something, it'll hit it and the debris will move away. So what you have to do is you need to hit it, but then close around it. So actually, even the net is quite special in that it's got a motorized sort of rope around it, so that when it hits an object, these motors start to close the noose effectively, and it actually grabs it, so then it can't float away.
Is this where Airbus come back into the equation again?
Exactly.
Did they develop the net and the harpoon?
Yes, yeah.
That makes perfect sense. So how soon did you test the net afterwards? Was that a whole different sort of job, or was it all done in fairly close proximity?
So the net was done a couple of months after launch. So we actually launched removed debris last year in June. So we actually did the net experiment first. The second experiment we did was actually another experiment using one of our CubeSats. And this was for basically testing our navigation cameras. This was another Airbus camera that we were testing. And what we did is we released one of our CubeSats. So again, we simulate space junk, or, you know, especially a sort of satellite type space junk. We released that from the mother spacecraft. And then we basically used our cameras on board to actually look at the spacecraft and see where we could, you know, see how good they were. Now, the key to this was actually our spacecraft has GPS on board. It knows where it is and what it's doing. So that could relay the data through what we call a brand new inter-satellite link. So the two spacecraft talk to each other. And that could relay the data of what it was doing and where it thought it was. And we can compare that to the camera. And then we can test how good the camera was at actually determining where the spacecraft was.
So how far away do you think we are from testing on a real piece of orbiting space junk?
Yeah, so this was the first test of any way we could deal with space debris. What's now happening is there's quite a few different missions and concepts going on to actually go up and test this for real now. Recently I was in Europe, it's been called EDORBIT. And that's probably going to be the first one that will actually go up to a real a real object and try and deorbit it.
That'll be exciting.
Yes, yeah.
So for this iteration of removed debris that's currently in orbit around Earth, when does this particular mission come to a close? Is it already fundamentally finished, this particular mission?
Yeah, removed debris is pretty much in its end stage now. Of course, we're still waiting for it to deorbit and come home to basically clear itself up. But in terms of the main demonstrations that we want to do, which is this vision-based navigation, this camera, the net and the harpoon, we're now all done. And fundamentally, it's been incredibly successful. So, you know, while, you know, little things haven't gone quite according to plan, which is completely expected for any research project, the fundamental reason for doing it, to prove that these technologies could be used, has completely been proved in all three technologies.
And so there's something very kind of visceral and like you were saying, using practices that have existed for years, nets,
exactly.
Harpoons, there's something very wonderful about that. And you were mentioning, of course, that the commerciality of a project like this is incredibly important, because the main way to make this a viable prospect for governments all around the world to get involved, of course, is going to be because of its cost.
Yeah.
And the cheaper it is, the more likely people are to be getting involved with this and to be committing budget towards it. Who's going to be responsible for it? Who are the main countries that really need to step up and commit budget towards removing debris from orbit?
Yeah, so basically the people that really need to step up is everybody who's created it in
right.
the first place. So certainly America, Europe, and Russia will the main ones, but there's even loads of smaller companies that are also getting into this now, because with like new space technologies and smaller spacecraft, it's become available for, you know, almost every country now to be able to get involved. So it's going to be every country and every corporation that's doing this that is going to be responsible. What you're going to see very soon is where base insurance comes into it. So where countries aren't willing to take on the responsibility themselves, so it's going to be passed on to the companies that are actually building these spacecraft.
Mm.
And of course, these companies, you know, they'll build a spacecraft, but they'll have to pay insurance effectively to indemnify themselves.
Okay.
And it sort of becomes a point where, do you keep on paying insurance because you have an object in space that could cause damage, or do you pay somebody to go and get it out from space so that you don't have that risk anymore? So it's sort of an insurance side of things that will probably end up really kicking it off for the removing the space debris.
It's funny to think there is an insurance company out there somewhere that has currently got a space indemnity program.
we have to use them.
Of course.
It's one of the things that we have to do every time we want to launch. We have to get insurance.
And so for you personally, what's next for you here at the Space Centre?
So I'm continuing to work on quite a lot of the other Space Centre programmes. So we're working on sort of camera systems. I continue to look after quite a few of our own spacecraft that are still, while they've been up there for a couple of years, we're still getting a lot of data from them, and a lot of that cross-working collaboration with other universities and other countries. And also starting to look at a lot of the next generation for CubeSats and for spacecraft. Because now we've had the first generation of the cheap Earth spacecraft. We're really now starting to look at, you know, how do you really move on from them and get the next generation of technology.
Well, thank you very much for joining me to talk about removed debris today. It was a really fascinating conversation, so thanks very much.
No problem, thank you.
Thanks again to Richard Duke for taking the time out to talk to me on a Saturday morning. about 20 minutes before he began a long day showing potential students around the Surrey Space Centre. Before we recorded the interview, Richard gave me a tour of the whole centre, and I even got to look around the lab where the satellites were developed. It really reminded me of exactly why I started doing this podcast in the first place, like meeting interesting people who are filled with passion for what they do, and then just try and capture a little bit of that in these conversations. And sharing it with you guys. And a great byproduct of this for me is getting a glimpse into things that otherwise I would just never have seen. So thanks again, Richard. Just to remind you, as if you needed reminding, because it was about half an hour ago that I last mentioned it, but my book, please buy it, or just have a look and see if you might like it, or at least send the link to someone that you think might like it. I've spent a ridiculous amount of time writing it, and my brother-in-law Andreas has spent as much time designing it, so go and have a look. unbound.com/books/dark. I've got a few really good guests lined up over the next month or so, so keep looking out for more episodes. And if you haven't already, give the podcast a little subscribe. I know it's been a couple of months since my last podcast, but in the grand scheme of things of the universe, that's literally no time at all, is it? So please subscribe, please buy my book. I'm starting to sound a little bit needy, so enough chit-chat. Or is it? If you're still with me now anyway, good grief, you're great. We're obviously in it for the long haul. I could carry on like this for another half an hour, another couple of hours, if you're up for it. It might even be like the mystery track on Nevermind, where you've got like 6 minutes of complete silence before it kicks in again. But I wouldn't do that to you, would I? Or would I?